welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Today's topic is tomorrow's semiconductors. With me is my podcast partner, Mike Gianfagna, and our guest is semiconductor legend, Jim Hogan. Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mike, and welcome to our podcast.
Good morning, guys. Glad to be here.
Good morning, Dan.
So, Jim, we normally start with a little history on how a specific technology got to where it is today before talking about where it will go tomorrow. But this time, let's start with you personally, how you got to where you are today in semiconductors. Then let's talk about what the future holds.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. Ordinarily don't talk about this much because it jumps all over the place. But basically, I grew up in the Valley. I grew up in San Jose. So therefore, I was exposed to semiconductor pretty early. Both my parents were semiconductor folks. And as a result, you know, it was part of my daily dose of reality brought to me by my parents. But what happened is, you know, because they were in semiconductor, of course, I didn't want to be in semiconductor. So I went off and did, you know, kind of pure math and physics in college. And I was working at that. And by then I was married and had a couple little kids. And I was working at NASA building simulators for bringing people back from orbits around the moon in case they lost Houston. And fortunately, no one ever had to use my program. But with that said, though, it was really fun working for NASA, but you didn't make any money. And so actually my parents said, why don't you consider semiconductor? And I went off and interviewed at three places, and it was a long time ago in the early 70s. And I had an offer from IBM for 12K, an offer from HP for 13K, and an offer from National Semiconductor for 14K. So I went with the 14K and ended up at National, and I ended up in the math shop.
Next, you moved to EDA. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, so I was in semiconductor for quite a while before EDA. I ended up working the math shop. That's obviously a link to EDA, and spent a lot of time working on, for example, physical verification. Design rule checking, for example, was something we worried a lot about. And in this particular case, Cadence had a relationship with National, and well, the people that wrote Dracula came from National, Paul Wong. And so we started talking quite a bit about that as Paul started his startup, later became Cadence. So in that, National became an investor in first SDA and then later Cadence. And I was responsible from the National side for the investment. And I took care of that for the National board. Later on, I joined Cadence, working for Jim Solomon. For those that don't know, Jim Solomon was the founder of this company called SDA that became Cadence. Jim is a really famous analog designer and just a terrific guy. And so the opportunity to work for Jim was really something I always wanted to do. And then later, working for Cadence as well made it very interesting. At that time, it was pretty early on, and Cadence really became a juggernaut, you know, in terms of growth. And by the early 90s, we were probably the number one EDA company in the world. And you know, that changed over time. But at least then, when I was there and starting at Cadence, it was really growing crazy. And at that time, led by Joe Costello.
So, Jim, that's interesting, the time at Cadence. I'd like to poke at one other thing that you did there. During your time there, there was an incredible number of acquisitions. In fact, Cadence got really big through a large number of acquisitions that you were an integral part of. Could you talk a little bit about what happened there during that time? It seemed to change the industry in the way acquisitions were done, frankly.
Well, it goes back to I was running a bit, you know, semiconductor R&D for a while, right? And it was always a challenge on the expense budget. And so what we realized over, at least I realized over time, is you can use the income statement or the balance sheet to fund these things. And if I look at new technology, there was always new technology required at every advancement of a process node, you know, something that was, you know, secondary, let's call it timing at 130 nanometers or something. You know, it was sort of interesting, but that 90, it became a requirement. So those next node always sort of presented an opportunity for a new technology that we really hadn't developed yet. So the question was, do we develop it ourselves, or do we look outside to buy it? So buy, build, or partner. Partner rarely works. So you're down to build or buy. And so in my opinion, it was less risky to buy. And our stock was doing well. So the balance sheet became something I could weaponize and go after opportunities to buy technology and get to market quickly. And so when I looked at market opportunities, they were generally things that had solving one of these problems that that required new technology on a successive node. But I also wanted to find things that had momentum, and I tried to pick the winners. And we used, the balance sheet and cash to do this. Now, at the same time, this is going to sound a bit of a criticism for Cadence, but you may recall there was this thing called Tality. It was a semiconductor design capability that we were trying to build at Cadence. Not my group, but adjacent to us. I was a product guy.
Remember
it
well.
And then, you were there. Yeah, we had to catch up on technology, and it also sort of reinforced we had to look at M&A. So when I looked at it, I sort of developed a roadmap of what technologies we needed and what technologies we needed in what sequence. And so some of the sequences were done purposely to, you may recall Avanti was our big competitor at that point. And so was there a way to box Avanti, and like for example with something like CADMOS, where CADMOS was in every Avanti account, so why don't I buy that and ensure that Cadence has always got a foot in the sales activity at those accounts? So what we tried to do was find things that were required to service whatever that design process was, and then also try to sequence them in the right order. And so I can't actually tell you how many we did. I think we did about 25 acquisitions over the course of, 8 years or so. The key was a couple of key things. When Joe was with the company, he says, never buy a company that has overlap with anything you did. So that was one of the big things we always tried to do, is find companies that had technology that looked like we're the winners. Customers will tell you who the winners are. Sales guys will reinforce that. And make sure you don't have any overlaps, so the integration becomes a little easier or a lot easier. And so that's the purpose, or rather the process that we followed on those acquisitions. And over time, it changed quite a bit, right? I mean, at first it was just physical design. Later it became, RTL and behavior level. And then we started adding IP when I was there. And so they continued to do that. In fact, the entire industry has. And so EDA still grows pretty significantly through M&A, in my opinion.
I think I met you during Cadence, but I know I spent some time with you on your next venture, which was ARM. So, Jim, tell me a little bit about ARM. Why did you go from EDA to processor IP?
It was a little more serendipitous than that, right? So I was still at Cadence, and I joined a board called Neurologic down in Southern California in San Diego. And they were building programmable IOs and PLLs, which are, pretty ubiquitous in terms of being on chips. And these were IP blocks. And so in the process of during Neurologic, we decided to sell that company. And I talked to Artisan, Mark Templeton, and we agreed on selling the company, came up with a price. I was still at Cadence, but working as a board member for Neurologic. And then I asked Mark, I said, now that Neurologic, we're all shareholders in Artisan, tell me a little bit about what's going on. And at this time, Artisan had just gone public in the late 90s, and the stock was like $6 or so. And we saw an opportunity maybe to recast, or rather just tell the story about Artisan and how important it was going to be. So I quit Cadence after a long time there. It was just time to go. you know, like it's something that younger people ask me all the time. Why did you quit? What made you quit? Nothing really. You know, you're with the company for 14, 15 years. You've had almost every job. It was time to try something different. So the opportunity to go work at Artisan and see if we could make that a more interesting asset came up. And so we worked at Artisan, and this was right after 9/11. Took it out in the public market. Got an enterprise value about $450 million. And then about a year later, it got sold to Arm for about $920 million, right? So that was a big increase in enterprise value that made everybody really happy. Now, Arm's rationalization for buying it was that they felt they had to have the physical IP to make their processors more effective, better performance, lower energy. So that's when Artisan went to Arm. And I just sort of skated out of that one. And then, interestingly enough, same time is when I went off and did a venture fund called Telos after that.
Okay, Jim, let's talk about your move to venture capital and give the listeners an idea of what really goes on.
Yeah, thanks. It's not what you think it is. Let's start there. You know, at first you think, well, great, I'm going to have all this money. I can invest in these really great companies and have all the success. Well, you know, anybody that studies this knows that only 10% of the companies actually make it, and that you have many, many more attempts than actual wins. So that's one of the first things you got to do is really try to look at, can you improve the odds of a winning combination? And so I learned a lot. Right. I haven't learned it. I don't think it's something you go to business school for. And I think guys that are really good at this are generally people from an operational background. You know, they've ran businesses or, you know, they've been CEO of businesses, for example, or head of sales, head of marketing, things like that. And because they understand what it takes to be successful in a business, as opposed to a pure finance guy. And I know I'm gonna get some bad reviews from finance guys. With that said, though, I had, $100 million I was responsible for, and I had to get that invested. And that essentially became five deals, right? So five deals in those days, you know, it was initial $5 to $15 million initial investment. And typically you had to keep back, you know, equal amount for subsequent investments. And so that meant I needed to find seven or eight deals that in the course of a fund runs 10 years, but a fund is first 3 years usually produces the unicorn. The 5 years usually have some, in using baseball analogy for a second, you get some triples and some doubles, and 7 years you get maybe a single or two, right? So you get sort of diminishing returns, well, magnitude of returns as time goes on. And then you're left with guys that aren't taking any money, but really aren't getting any place, kind of the walking dead. And then, by the way, you know, you want all the failures to occur really early too, right? You know, if you're going to have out of 10 investments, you know, three failures, try to get them out of the way right away, right? So that I had to learn. And it turns out, you know, you can't mess with statistics, basically. You got to learn to kind of pace yourself and strategize along those lines. A thing that you may not realize about VCs is they get a management fee for the first 7 years. After that, they don't. So if something hasn't sold by year seven, it's not something that's interesting to many people, and the limited partners are pushing you pretty hard to get rid of it. So you'll see a lot of people liquidate at year seven. So all the money is made year three to year five. So that's something I had to learn. Now, other people may have other anecdotal experience, but that's been my experience. In subsequent years, as practicing as an individual fund, you know, one fund I fund myself, you know, my odds have gotten a little better. And the reason I bring that up is I think you get better at perfecting your data and your process in time. So it's, you know, like anything, you get a little better at what you're doing. So it's one of the ironies as I get towards the sunset of my career that I actually know what I'm doing, you know, and being successful. It's a shame that it didn't happen to me when I was 30. Anyway, I think it's hilarious.
I have the same feeling. I wish I had a lot more energy to leverage my
Oh,
experience.
yeah.
So Jim, last year was a big year for acquisitions, and specifically
Yeah.
the Nvidia ARM acquisition kind of blew my mind. I think that is probably one of the most disruptive acquisitions that we're going to see in some time. So based on that, what happens next in the processor wars?
Good question. Good question. Let's examine the ARM deal, which hasn't closed yet. If you're NVIDIA, if you look at the NVIDIA stock, it's quadrupled in the last couple of years, right? And so they're using basically some cash, about $10 billion, as I recall, and the rest is stock, NVIDIA stock. So that stock really has really become very valuable. And as a result, they're buying ARM for stock. So that's amazing. So they had the currency to buy ARM at basically a discount to themselves, right? So why did they buy ARM? Well, look, they're doing really well, NVIDIA, in the edge-based processing world, right? And automotive, for example, there's no one doing better than NVIDIA in AI up on the edge, right? Where's the next opportunity for them? Server farm, the data centers, things like that. So I think when I look at it, the war needs to move with Intel, at least, and NVIDIA to this data center, the server farms, the cloud. And we'll see that happen, I believe, right? And that's going to be really interesting. Now, what happens to ARM in terms of servicing the, let's call it the AI functions on the edge, the sort of autonomous intelligence that needs to occur on the edge, let's just say braking systems in a car or sensors in a manufacturing facility. Who's going to get that business? Let's park that for a second. The other big acquisition that's announced and trying to happen is AMD Xilinx, right? So basically, if we look at AMD Xilinx, it's kind of replicating the Intel Altera acquisition. And that's all going to be about server farms, clouds. And the FPGA part of the business, Altera, or in this case, Xilinx, is the thing that's parsing the jobs for the servers. So the FPGAs are there to be an intelligent parser to ensure that you can utilize the servers in the data center as fast as you can. So we'll see some incredible technology gains in cloud-based technology and the ability for the hardware to do a lot more. So the race is on. Okay, back to that. We parked autonomous intelligence on the edge. So who's going to do that, right? So it's my contention that is where the RISC-V architecture is going to play. RISC-V's got a bunch of advantages. You don't pay the tax to a specific architecture guy like ARM, and as a result, you have some advantages in the command structure or rather the execution structure, where you don't need 120 operations. You probably only need three, and as a result, there's a lot less power consumed and it runs a lot quicker. So I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of RISC-V based starts. And I was looking at the RISC-V Foundation data, and they had some incredible numbers, like 30% of the FPGA started now are on RISC-V. A lot of ASICs, like hundreds of billions of dollars of RISC-V revenue is being produced now. So the thing's just growing like crazy. Now, is that going to force ARM or Intel or AMD off the planet? No way, right? That's going to grow. But it's kind of bifurcated into the big data center stuff and the edge-based stuff, right? And so if you look at now a little advertisement for one of my entities called Silicon Catalyst, which is an incubator. If I look at the incubator and the little startups we see, they're all edge-based by and large, and they're all using some kind of open source processor, and typically it's RISC-V. So I think over the course of next year, we'll see two large digital markets grow. Now, the question is, from my standpoint, on the edge, is it 32-bit or 64-bit? I think for a lot of these things, 32 is probably sufficient. So we'll see how that bifurcates.
That was a great summary, Jim. Thank you. And I agree completely, especially about RISC-V. We see a lot of RISC-V traffic on SemiWiki. It was kind of like deja vu of when IoT first came out. We had a huge amount of IoT traffic and people thought it was hype. But as we saw the transition from hype to revenue go pretty quickly, you know, now IoT is a staggering market. So I think RISC-V has the same opportunity. So Jim, just on a personal side, what do you do when you're not wheeling and dealing behind the curtains here?
Oh, wow, thanks. That may be a long answer, but I'll try to make it short. So, you know, my problem in life is I've always been ADD. So everybody says, well, how did you get the job you had? Well, I basically had to invent a job for myself because there wasn't a job really for me, right? I had to get one where I didn't annoy everybody all the time. So this, as you get older, I think, what you do is you turn inwardly and you got to, especially if you're an ADD type person, you got to shorten the list a little bit. So what's always interested me is technology, and the venture opportunity really scratches that itch. It's a lot of fun. I get to work with really smart young people, and it's just terrific. But there's a couple other things that sort of been with me for a long time. You know, I grew up on a farm in Santa Cruz Mountains, right? Or always around, you know, in the mountains here in lumber industry with my grandparents and stuff. So I have a small farm, and I spend a fair amount of time on that. And just like any other pursuit in life, you know, you build an understanding of it, get a little better at it. And I'm happy. You know, my kids, poor guys, bought some of my wine a few times, and it hasn't gone bad yet. So he's still drinking it, I think.
And, yeah, well, I'll interrupt you there. It's a 2007 Pinot Noir that we opened just a few nights ago, and it's still alive and well, Jim. Well done.
That's good to hear. So 1 year, by the way, I was trying to be cheap because, you know, it costs a lot of money to do these things. So I went from corks, which are about $1.50 a piece when you buy a lot of them. I went to plastic corks. Everybody said, oh, you got to go plastic or screw on ones. Well, I went to plastic. You know, what I learned is that wine's got to breathe for the life of the wine. And those plastic corks are a really bad idea, right? So there was 1 year that got thrown out of the window, but there's an example. The other thing that seems to go with the math and the technology a lot is music, right? I grew up in a household where we didn't have a TV. We basically had to read or play an instrument. That was it. And so I grew up playing a lot and playing in a band and in high school and college and played in, you know, orchestra and all that stuff too. But I joined a bunch of bands, and I was really fortunate to get with guys that became studio musicians. Not that I'm that good, but they are. So I tagged along. I really got to see a lot of great, great music produced. And so I'm still doing that. And then I really enjoyed playing with some folks and sharing that experience. One of the real hard things about the whole pan epidemic is that we haven't been able to get together to play. And that I realize now that that's so so hard for us to do. In fact, if you let me go off for a little bit, so we lost a good friend this year, Randy Smith. And Randy was a blogger on Dan's site. And Randy was also a singer in my band. And the way I found Randy is we were in Japan, we were in Tokyo, and there was a karaoke contest down at Roppongi. And Randy won the karaoke contest. So I signed him up to the band when we were in Japan. And Randy was in my band for 25 years. So anyway, poor Randy, he passed this year. And I sort of realized, here we are, you know, 8 or 9 months later, that Randy was my musical muse. So the music just takes you places that are different. It's a right brain, left brain thing. So I'm sure people play golf, people race boats, people fish. You know, that left brain is as important as the right brain. So, and music's been one of my left brain things.
Well, Jim, I agree with you about the left brain, right brain thing of keeping things balanced, especially during the pandemic. For me, I sail. I sail in the San Francisco Bay and out the Golden Gate. It is both left and right brain, but it is a partnership with Mother Nature. And it truly is a blessing during, you know, these trying times. I think this is a good place to stop. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Jim, for the excellent content. And we hope to see you again soon. That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.